I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be discussing the potential decline of American primacy and the failures of the United States foreign policy elite with a leading scholar of international relations from Harvard University, Dr. Stephen Walt. Author of such books as The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, co-written with John Mearsheimer, Taming American Power, and most recently, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite, and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. In this conversation, we focus on many aspects from that book, as well as his recent article in Foreign Policy entitled, Could the United States Still Lead the World If It Wanted To? We'll also discuss what is the realist school of foreign policy, defining the American foreign policy establishment, and much, much more in this wide-ranging conversation that I hope you will find as enlightening as I did. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Dr. Stephen Walt. Welcome to Parallax Views. Stephen Walt, Professor of International Affairs at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. How are you doing today?
I'm just fine. How are you?
Pretty good. And I'm so glad to have you on the show because you have a really interesting piece at Foreign Policy entitled, Could the United States Still Lead the World If It Wanted To? Bit gloomy in some places. We'll get into that. But first, it's interesting. I was just talking to another friend of mine who is into foreign policy who said, Walt, he's really against American primacy. And then on the other hand, I was reading up on a contemporary of yours, Richard Falk, and Richard Falk has actually been more critical of you, saying that, I mean, he's a fan, but he has said, I think Stephen is too attached to American primacy. So putting aside both those sort of viewpoints that I got from those individuals, where do you stand on the issue of American primacy, leadership, and foreign policy?
Well, I think you have to kind of distinguish between several things. I would define primacy as, basically whether the United States is the strongest power in the world. That's a separate question from what sort of leadership it then uses that power to exercise and what its foreign policy is. And I do actually support the idea of the United States trying to remain the strongest, wealthiest, et cetera, country in the world for a whole variety of reasons. My concerns over the past, 10 to 20 years or more is it two things. One is we're doing things with that enormous power that we have that are both causing us to lose it faster, but also aren't making the world a better place. We're not using the power in a positive way. So in principle, I don't think we would be better off if the United States was substantially weaker than a whole series of other powers. I'd like the United States to retain a position of primacy, but I would like it to use its power more wisely, both in ways that would benefit Americans, but I think would also be much better for the rest of the world.
At the same time, I take it you also believe that, you know, there does need to be room for, you know, more international cooperation. And I think even a colleague of yours, John Mersheimer, has pointed that out in The Great Tragedy of Power Politics. And I think sometimes people ignore that when it comes to, I guess, what's been called the realist school. You're not saying that international cooperation isn't important or very valuable to a better world.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think realists all recognize that, first of all, international cooperation is essential in a variety of different realms, and it happens all the time. There are many ways on every single day that countries are collaborating with each other and making adjustments and making the world economy work in a variety of different ways. And we need more of that in issues such as climate change. I think the point that realists like Professor Mersheimer and myself make is that international cooperation is often hard to sustain. It can be fragile. There are a number of powerful obstacles to it. And one has to think rather carefully about how you conduct yourself in order to maximize cooperation in the areas where it's most necessary, even though you recognize that at times it's going to be difficult to preserve it.
Now, I just want to back up for a second because I have a lot of younger listeners. I live around a college town. They listen to this show, and some of them are just getting very interested in international relations, foreign policy, and whatnot. And some of them may be saying, well, what's the realist school of foreign policy? Maybe you could give a brief outline of what that is.
I'll certainly try. So realism or the realist school is a sort of broad approach to thinking about international politics, politics in general, you could argue, but especially international politics. And I think the key argument for all realists, although we disagree on details and specifics, the key argument for all realists is that international politics takes place in a system that has no single overarching authority. There is no world government to keep order, to protect states from each other, to preserve peace. And therefore, it is a self-help system. Each state in the international system ultimately has to rely upon its own resources, its own strategies in order to try and be secure. Well, the difficulty there, of course, is that that tends to breed a lot of insecurity. Country A does something to try and make itself feel safer, and that makes country B feel less safe as well. So realists tend to have a rather pessimistic view of how international politics is going to proceed, not because states might not want to cooperate, might not want to live in peace, might not want to get along all the time, but because they can't be sure what other states might do. They might, come under the control of an ambitious aggressor, and therefore they're forced to try to protect themselves. So the title of Professor Mersheimer's book, Tragedy of Great Power Politics, captures that rather nicely. Human beings are in a somewhat tragic situation. In the absence of an overarching government to protect states from each other, they're going to compete with each other, and sometimes that competition is going to lead to very nasty things like big wars.
And I just wanted to add to that because I feel like people always miss the part of Professor Mersheimer's book where he says, well, it doesn't mean that it's always going to be that way. We could have a more world system, but right now, this is the world we live in. I guess since you said that there's different sort of schools of realist thought, one thing I always get is people will say, oh, the realists, that's like Henry Kissinger, right? But I get the impression you may disagree with Henry Kissinger on quite a few things. So maybe you could talk about the differences you have with other realists.
Yeah. So I'll save Kissinger for the end because he's a very interesting case. But I think the principal difference among realists is the degree to which they think the system that I was describing drives behavior. That all states and especially all great powers are forced by their circumstances to behave pretty much in the same way. And the extent to which, on the other hand, they might acknowledge that other forces are important. So someone like John Mearsheimer really thinks the system is very powerful. That sort of 70%, 75% of world politics is pretty much explained by this condition of anarchy, by the balance of power, things like that. Somebody like me would probably say that's more like 50, 55% of what goes on. And for me, I leave more space for domestic politics, for ideological conflict, for changes in military technology. And still other realists might allow for, you know, well, the system is 40% of what goes on and it's very important, but there's a lot that can be done at the domestic level or with institutions or whatever. I think that's the principal way that realists may agree or disagree with each other. Kissinger is a very interesting case. He is, I think, in some ways, not even a realist, although he's often regarded as such because he was so, you know, uninterested in things like human rights and very concerned with the balance of power. What's interesting is that on most issues in world politics in Kissinger's lifetime, he has been out of step with his fellow realists. Kissinger, you know, supported prolonging the Vietnam War, even though realists like George Kennan and Walter Lippmann and Kenneth Waltz and Hans Morgenthau all thought staying in Vietnam was a stupid idea. Kissinger felt differently. Most modern realists opposed the war in Iraq in 2003. Kissinger supported it. Most realists thought expanding NATO into Eastern Europe was a mistake. Kissinger supported that. And I think the reason is that Kissinger, unlike most realists, believes reputation is all important, and that if you're seen as weak, your allies will abandon you, they'll realign with the other side, and therefore you had to fight all the time to show people you were still tough and strong. Most realists like me would say, actually, if you don't appear quite so powerful or quite so willing to fight, others are going to be more willing to support you, that looking excessively aggressive is actually a good way of generating opposition. To put it in international relations theory terms, Kissinger is a bandwagoner. He thinks states jump on the bandwagon and join the winning side whenever they see it. And people like me believe in the balance of power, that states tend to flock to the weaker side to keep any single state from dominating, which, by the way, is something the United States has been dealing with ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. The fact that other states are worried about American power and taking various steps to try and keep it in check.
So before we get into this question of American leadership, I think the big lead-in that we have to talk about is our former president, Donald Trump. And, you know, I'll preface this with saying, you know, there were things he would say, like drain the swamp, that, you know, I had some sympathy for, not necessarily in a Republican way, but in a sense of, oh, we have a lot of these institutions that I think are atrophied. So maybe we do need to shake things up. But I don't think the Trump presidency worked out in a way that was very beneficial. I don't think it did much of any kind of real draining of the swamp that we need it.
I think there's no question of that. I think I'd agree with you that Trump, when he ran for president in 2016, had not very well informed, but actually fairly good instincts on a number of issues. One, that American foreign policy had kind of gone off the rails. He talked about how we were fighting these crazy nation building wars in various places, and he wasn't going to do that. He was critical of our allies for free riding, or, you know, not pulling their weight in various alliance commitments that we'd made. He, I think, recognized sooner than many had that, China was really a serious rival, and we needed to pay more attention to trying to deal with that. So his instincts on a number of questions weren't terrible. What was wrong is two things. One is he had no idea how to address any of these problems and was a completely incoherent manager, undisciplined, didn't want to take advice. So many of the things he did to try to address the problems he'd identified made things worse, or at least didn't solve them. And second, his defects of character, I think, were fatal in a variety of ways. He didn't want to actually spend much time governing. He liked going to rallies and giving wild speeches and finding new ways to make money at the expense of the rest of us. But some of his instincts, including the possibility that at least some parts of the government had gotten a little bit complacent, were probably accurate. It's too bad he didn't do anything positive to improve them, and in some ways actually damaged many institutions of the U.S. government that actually weren't working all that badly.
Do you think that part of the problem may be that, you know, Trump has to hire people for his team, right? And ultimately, D.C., I think, produces a very particular type of person, socialized in the same way, a lot of times going to the same schools. So he may want to hire people that have his views on foreign policy, but you're still going to have to hire a bunch of people on your team that are, you know, people like John Bolton. Do you think that's a problem that any and every president ends up facing if they have a sort of disagreement with what's been called the foreign policy blob, as Ben right. Rhodes referred to it?
Yeah, this, I mean, in a sense, I wrote an entire book on this subject called The Hell of Good Intentions, which is about the foreign policy elite. And I think Trump very much had this problem. He arrived with very different views on a number of foreign policy questions, and had no one or hardly anyone that he could bring in to try and implement that vision in an intelligent way. And you might have been able to find a handful of people who agreed with him, but most of them either didn't have any real government experience, so they were going to screw up just by virtue of, you know, rookie mistakes. Or they were oddballs, nutcases, like somebody like Mike Flynn, his first national security advisor. I don't really know what Flynn's foreign policy views really were, but he clearly had no idea what he was doing and has since sort of gone off the deep end. But the point is that if Trump tried to fill his administration with experienced people who knew how to conduct foreign policy, or at least make the machinery run, they were going to go back to the same old foreign policy. And that's, in fact, pretty much what happened, not entirely. I would just point out that Barack Obama had the same problem when he became president in 2009. It's quite clear that Obama wanted to do things significantly differently than the rest of the Democratic Party foreign policy, you know, apparatchiks. His views on a lot of foreign policy questions were not radical, but they were somewhat different. But of course, he ended up filling his administration with familiar figures from, as Ben Rhodes put it, from the blob, and they tended to resist most of his bolder initiatives in a variety of ways. But I think this is, in fact, a substantial problem for any U.S. president who wants to take a different swing at our relationship with the rest of the world. And I think to some degree, you're seeing that now in the Biden administration as well, which is populated with very much a set of sort of Washington insiders with the same views. They've all worked together, and you're not seeing a whole lot in the way of really innovative outside the box thinking.
I just wanted to add to that. I always am reminded of a story that Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was chief of staff, of course, under Colin Powell, in case people don't know, he always told me that Barack Obama would tell people that this town has a pro-war bias. So he definitely had views on foreign policy. With regards to Trump, I want to get your analysis on this because it's been going around in my head for a while. I hear all these excuses for Trump. The military establishment went against him, yada, 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 yada. And I just say, you know what? I don't care. I just don't care. I feel that Donald Trump, and I'm not trying to be, you know, all angry about it, but it does sort of enrage me. I feel like Trump has set us back at least, you know, 10, 20 years in terms of addressing institutions that are in need of reform and that are very much atrophied at this point. They need to change, but they think, oh my God, we had to deal with this Trump guy we don't want to change now. Look what happened when we tried that. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree in general. I mean, Trump was a disaster as president in a whole variety of ways. I mean, first of all, some of the institutions that I think we need very much for a more constructive relationship with the rest of the world. And here I'd highlight the State Department. The State Department was in terrible shape under Trump and got worse steadily. Morale was a disaster. His first appointment, Rex Tillerson, was ineffective and unpopular inside the building. We tried to do various reforms, didn't get anywhere with that, didn't do them very effectively, in my view. And then Mike Pompeo, I think, was even worse in some respects, rather dismissive of the diplomatic corps, you know, some pretty crazy ideas himself. Not clear if he was more interested in being Secretary of State or preparing himself for a presidential run. And you could move around the government and point in other places as well, where we lost a lot of very talented, experienced people. You'll notice that there were people within the State Department who, you know, were some of the people who blew the whistle on what Trump was doing with Ukraine as well, which was, I think, a patriotic act on their part. So he was certainly not good for the machinery of government, you know, having competent people who were respected and rewarded for doing their jobs well. But he was also a strategic nincompoop. And I'll give you just one example. You know, I mentioned that he really thought we needed to take China seriously, and in particular, push China on some of the ways it was violating trade agreements, things it had promised to do when it joined the World Trade Organization. And I think there was a growing consensus that something had to be done about that. But what does Trump do? Well, he launches a rather poorly designed trade war with China. But at the same time, he tries to have a trade war with South Korea, with Japan, with the European Union, instead of bringing all of our democratic allies together and our trading partners together to confront China with a united front. He picked fights with everybody and as a result, got nowhere with any of them. Right. That's just, you know, bad strategy. So even when he had sort of good foreign policy instincts, his inability to put them together and then to work with the professionals in the government to implement an effective strategy, I think, was fatal to his, you know, his ability to actually accomplish some of the things that would have been both good for the country and, ironically, good for his electoral prospects in 2020.
So I know I keep coming back to that word, atrophied. Do you think that the way Trump did business has sort of kept us from maybe, like, I'm not asking for a revolution or anything. I'm saying, you know, maybe we do need some changes in foreign policy, but I feel like a lot of people are becoming more reticent about, oh, maybe we shouldn't try that much reform because look what happened when this crazy guy came along.
Yeah. Well, I think he did, to some degree, discredit some of the ideas that, you know, he might have tried to bring in a little bit. But some of those, I think, are actually sort of determined structurally. So, you know, Trump had said and clearly wanted to get out of Afghanistan. He'd said it was a waste of American resources, no longer critical. He was president for 4 years. He was commander in chief of the armed forces, and he never got us out. In fact, he sent more troops in his first year as president as well. It has taken Joe Biden to be the first president to finally sort of own up to the fact that the United States is not going to win the war in Afghanistan and that it's not going to affect what happens in Afghanistan if we stay longer. We certainly could stay longer. The cost was bearable. But the point is, if we stayed another 5 years or another 10 years, we'd be facing the same problem. Afghanistan wouldn't be in any better shape. The Taliban wouldn't be any closer to defeat as well. And I think Biden had the courage to recognize that and take the political heat that is undoubtedly going to come his way, because the situation in Afghanistan is going to get worse. My point is, it was going to get worse whenever we changed. I mention that because it's an example of the United States starting to come to terms with the fact that it needs to change some, not all, but some of the ways it is engaged in the world, some of the missions it has set for itself, alter both the way it does business, but also some of the priorities and strategies that it's followed in the past. And you know, Trump failed to do that. I think Biden will face some resistance to it. He's very much a mainstream sort of centrist himself. But I think international circumstances and the situation that facing the country is going to push, you know, the Biden administration and whoever succeeds Biden in more or less the same direction, regardless of what's going on with who gets, you know, put in particular jobs over the passage of time. One final thing here is, I do think you're going to see gradual generational change within the government. The people who, you know, grew up in the Cold War and got their first jobs, you know, in the 90s, those people are going to age out. And the next generation who are starting to move into positions of authority or at least starting to begin their careers have very different views on foreign policy and America's role. And it's not an isolationist view. It's not like they want to come home and put up big barriers and never trade and never engage diplomatically. It's just they have a different view of what the proper use of American power is and what issues are most important. Climate change matters more to 20-somethings than, say, international terrorism. And that's, I think, both a correct judgment, but it's also one that has real implications for how the United States allocates its foreign policy resources.
I was just going to add to that. I get the feeling that, you know, a lot of people, I think, get really impatient and they want to see the change happen really quickly. But it seems like we're at a transition point where, you know, as a new generation starts taking power from an older generation, we may begin seeing more change.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, and it's the American system of government is kind of a funny one, right? On the one hand, it's designed not to change quickly. Lots of checks and balances, lots of veto points within government. So we're a society where it's hard to get the government to turn on a dime, as you just said. But it is interesting to note that in moments of genuine national emergency, the U.S. government can actually respond with extraordinary agility. I think we saw this, you know, in World War II, where we went from sort of less than fully prepared to fully mobilized quite rapidly. I think you saw something similar after September 11th. I don't agree with all of the things the Bush administration did. Some of them, of course, proved to be disastrous. But boy, they moved quickly. And the country was behind them, whether it's, you know, the Patriot Act or the initial invasion of Afghanistan, et cetera. So, you know, it's possible that we will see a much more rapid shifting in priorities and actions in the next decade or so than you might expect if you just looked at the typical level of gridlock in Washington right now.
Since we mentioned the blob earlier, I feel like I try to use the blob a lot more now. And, you know, I hear other people use the term, oh, it's the deep state, but I don't want to use that term because too many Trumpists use that term at this point. But when we say the blob, people sort of look at me askance. They're like, well, what does that mean? So to give my listeners an idea of what it is, what exactly is the blob, the foreign policy establishment?
Yeah, I think in my book, I use the blob term once or twice, but mostly I like to call it either the foreign policy establishment or the foreign policy elite. And I want to make a distinction, which I'll get to in a second, within that. But I tend to think of it as the following. It's obviously the people who are working in government at the National Security Council, the CIA, the Defense Department, State Department, et cetera, other parts of government, even people who are, say, foreign policy staffers up on Capitol Hill. Then I would also include people who work at think tanks like Brookings, the Center for New American Security, the Carnegie Endowment. These are often people who are going in and out of government, depending on who's in power. They write books and articles and op-eds trying to shape policy. So I'd include them as well. I would add journalists who work on foreign policy. You know, Tom Friedman of the New York Times, who writes on foreign policy, is a member of the foreign policy establishment as well. You would include academics like me, You know, I'm a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. I teach at the Kennedy School, which is a bastion of the establishment as well. So you'd include, you know, people in academia. I basically think of it as anybody who is their full-time activity is focused around around international affairs. And the argument I make in my book is that although there are some disagreements within those various groups, there is a pretty profound consensus among most members of the foreign policy establishment that the United States should be number one. It should exercise global leadership. It should be trying to use its power to spread American values far and wide. And as you alluded to earlier, within that group, there's also something of a bias, not in favor of using military force because force is fun to use, but rather because we have so much of it and it's easy to use it with relatively few consequences for the United States. You know the old line that when all you have is a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. And in a sense, because the United States was militarily so capable over the last 20 or 25 years, many presidents found that to be the easiest solution to difficult foreign policy problems. Let's go blow something up. And rather than trying to the more sort of slow, patient working out of foreign policy problems that often takes longer, is less satisfying, but may work much better in the long run.
Well, I think that in a lot of ways manages to sum up your book, The Hell of Good Intentions. But in terms of this hell of good intentions, where do you think things really go sideways, so to speak? Is it Vietnam or is it the post 9/11 wars? Where do you pinpoint it?
Well, Vietnam was clearly, you know, a huge mistake with considerable consequences here for the United States. But more importantly, for the people of Indochina, the place the book focuses on is the post-Cold War era, where the United States, you know, finds itself in the early 1990s in this extraordinary position. We're on good terms with all the other powers in the world, or all the other major powers, including Russia and China. We have a robust economy. We have, you know, unmatched military capabilities. And in the early 1990s, we think the world is going in our direction. You know, the wind is at our back. Democracy is spreading. Markets are opening up. Globalization's beginning. And we think that this is just going to continue, that the whole world is going to sort of gradually gravitate towards our model. Yes, Ewan?
If I could, real quick, I think the term a lot of people would use is people would say, well, the U.S. has become not just the superpower, but we are the hyperpower now.
Yeah, that was a phrase I think actually coined by the French foreign minister. Foreign Minister Vedrine called us the hyperpower. But yes, we saw ourselves in a place of our own. And very importantly, we thought that big historical forces were pushing everybody towards the American model. We were the only game in town, really. And everybody was going to become like a little copy of America.
I just wanted to add to that real quick. I keep thinking Francis Fukuyama, the end of history.
Right, exactly. This was very much. And if you read Tom Friedman's book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, he makes a similar argument that in a globalized world, you have to become pretty much like America, you know, democratic, rule of law, market-based, et cetera. And so people thought China, you know, now China's coming along. It's run by a communist party. It's authoritarian. But as it develops economically, the middle class will emerge there. They'll want political parties. They'll become democratic as well. And because we know, quote unquote, that democracies don't fight each other, we're going to live in this wonderful world of peace and harmony with just a few little dictators here and there that are kind of troublesome, you know, in Iraq or in Libya or in North Korea. But the rest of the world was going to be prosperous, peaceful, and wonderful. All of this backed up by American power, all of this safeguarded by the mighty and virtuous United States. So where did we go wrong? Well, I think what we made several errors. One is we forgot that our power was going to make others nervous. Even some of our friends would worry about how we were going to use this capability. Second, we vastly overestimated the degree to which the United States could spread this model of sort of liberal democracy into other places, including places that had never been democratic before. That's obviously been exposed in places like Iraq, where we went there saying we were going to turn it into a democracy, and that didn't work. It didn't work in Afghanistan, but it's not worked all that well in places like Hungary or Poland, which we, you know, we were overjoyed when communism fell and they became democratic, and they now seem to be backsliding in the other direction as well. That's been true in some other places around the world. So I think we greatly exaggerated the degree to which the world was going to adopt, you know, the American system. We also, I think, greatly underestimated the degree to which some other countries would be able to not defeat us, but check us. And certainly Russia, you know, which was basically flat on its back in the 1990s and couldn't put up much resistance, is now back, not anywhere near as powerful as we are, but able to check the United States in a number of places. China, of course, has come on much more powerfully, much more capably, and it has begun to work with Russia to help check us as well. And even some weak states were able to cause us far more trouble than we thought. You know, we, despite 20 years of sanctions, we were not able to prevent Iran from getting the capability of building a nuclear weapon if it wants to. They haven't decided they want to. So we both exaggerated the degree to which the rest of the world was sort of naturally going to head in our direction, and we exaggerated our ability to impose our will on the rest of the world as well. And we faced, instead of rather rather depressing and consistent backlash against that.
I just wanted to add to that. What I always tell people, and maybe you'll agree or disagree with this metaphor, I don't know. I always say to people, I feel like we did the one thing you never do in a game. You never show all your cards. And I felt like we really did that in the post 9/11 era, because I think that illusion that we were the hyperpower, I think after everything we saw in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we saw the sanctions in Iran, as you mentioned, they haven't worked. And I think once all these other countries see that, it's like, oh, maybe the great game is back on.
Yeah, I don't know. It was certainly a case of hubris on America's part. We just, and the thing that I think I found most discouraging in writing that book was that the same mistakes kept getting made over and over again, that there was relatively little learning happening, that when things went south, we didn't draw the right lessons. So it's quite striking that although there were differences between the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations in how they thought about foreign policy, the differences are not as significant as the similarities. All of them wanted to spread democracy. All of them thought that was America's mission. All of them relied on military force to do that. You know, Barack Obama conducted more drone strikes than George W. Bush did. Obama, you know, said he was going to get us out of these wars, and he ultimately didn't either. And then what's most interesting is you get Donald Trump coming in, who says he's going to do everything different, that all of those people before him didn't understand what was going on. And he does a lot of the same things that they do, too. And that's when people started thinking, you know, well, maybe this idea that the foreign policy establishment is kind of on autopilot and not really learning from its past mistakes, maybe that view has some basis to it.
So this is a really blunt question, but I don't know how else to ask it. Why has this establishment never really been held to account?
That is a great question. And I actually have a whole chapter in the book that writes about that, or that talks about that. I mean, I think part of it is that, first of all, when something goes wrong in foreign policy, there often several reasons why it's happened. So you're not going to get people agreeing on who was at fault, who was responsible. Second, sometimes it's hard to put the finger on a single individual or a couple of individuals. It was a team effort. There's lots of blame to go around. Third, of course, the foreign policy establishment is somewhat self-protective, right? They all have the concern that, you know, gee, I don't want to be too harsh on this person who screwed up because that could be me down the road. So there is this remarkable tendency to forgive people who have screwed up. But we have a whole series of people, you know, think of someone like Elliot Abrams, right, who's convicted or indicted for lying to Congress, pardoned by the first President Bush, goes back into the second Bush administration.
That was Iran-Contra, right?
He got in trouble for lying to Congress over Iran-Contra, comes back in the second Bush administration, George W. Bush's administration, screws up a bunch of stuff in the Middle East, goes off, spends a few years at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he doesn't exactly cover himself with glory. And guess what? He's back in at the Trump administration to screw up Venezuela even more than the Venezuelans had already done it, which is saying something. And of course, doesn't accomplish his mission there either. And of course, now goes back to a safe sinecure. You could point to John Bolton. There are examples on the Democratic side too. And I think part of this is the sort of the self-protective overlapping network in Washington effect. But, and I want to make this last point very clearly, the other thing to remember is you want to hold people accountable, but one has to be a little bit careful in doing that, right? Because all of us are human, we all make mistakes, and foreign policy can be difficult. So if somebody makes a mistake early in their career, you don't want to necessarily say, okay, you never have a job again.
You don't want to be Donald Trump saying, you're fired.
Right, exactly. And lots of people get better over time, right? They learn from experience, as we all do. What you do have to worry about is, first of all, there are some errors that are so egregious that they do raise real questions about someone's judgment, reliability, even, I would argue, loyalty. And that, I think, is grounds for, you know, sort of permanent dismissal. But also, if you see people making the same mistake over and over and over again, at some point you can start to say, all right, has John Bolton ever been right about anything? Maybe we don't want to bring him back in because he's got a track record, not of a year or two, but a track record of 25 or 30. And maybe he's someone that, you know, if he wants to write things and publish them, that's great, but let's not give him a job with any real responsibility. So accountability, I think, is very important and often severely lacking in the foreign policy elite, but you don't want to have, you know, an instantaneous guillotine either as well. You want to be mindful of that.
So before we wrap up, I just want to get into this article, as much of it as we can. You ask two main questions, and the answer to both those questions on balance is no. Let's tackle the first question we need to answer is whether the United States is a good model for other liberal states. You're saying, no, it isn't. Why not?
Well, you know, one way to lead is by setting a good example that others want to emulate and imitate. And if you look at the current condition of American democracy, you'd really wonder whether or not we're much of an example as well. You know, I point out in the article that The Economist magazine, which is a rather conservative publication, downgraded the United States from the category of full democracy to the category of flawed democracy a few years ago, and it's still there. Our voter turnout is relatively low among advanced democracies. I think we're only 26th in the world. 25% of Americans and 53% of Republicans say that Donald Trump won the 2020 election, even though there's no evidence to suggest that at all. And of course, any Republicans who say that that's not the case, that Biden won legitimately, have no place in the Republican Party. Someone like Liz Cheney, who's certainly conservative, no longer has any leadership positions as well. And we've been seeing a sort of steady campaign to restrict voting in this country that's supposed to prize democracy as well.
Weakening the 1965 Voting Rights Act, yeah.
Among others, but also instituting at the state level a whole series of restrictions, making it harder to vote, which hardly is consistent with democratic principles. But it's not just voting. So, you know, we like to call ourselves the land of the free, and yet we have the highest incarceration rate in the entire world. It's about double that of Russia as a percentage of population that are in jail. And that makes you wonder a little bit. You know, our tax system is riddled with fraud, lots of people who are cheating on their taxes. In a whole series of other realms, the national security establishment, very secretive, very hard to keep track of what it's doing, more inclined to prosecute whistleblowers and journalists who get secrets from whistleblowers than they used to be. So it's at this stage of the game, you know, pretty hard to look at the condition of American democracy and say, well, this is something we really ought to hold up to the rest of the world. You know, wouldn't you like to have a political system that works this well? And again, look at how much gridlock and partisan wrangling there is now in Congress. Not to mention, last but not least, not to mention what I sometimes think of as a sort of epidemic of unreason that has broken out. So you have substantial fractions of the population, you know, believing that these wonderful vaccines that actually provide us with the capacity to get past a global pandemic, the thing that they are more dangerous than the disease, or even worse, you know, those who believe the whole series of QAnon fairy tales about the government being controlled by a bunch of pedophiles operating out of a pizza parlor. I mean, it's lunacy, and yet a substantial fraction of the population believes it. And again, that's pretty hard to hold that up to another country and say, you want your government to look like that, don't you? So in that sense, we're not doing a very good job of leading.
I want to get to that second question you posed, but I wanted to know, I mean, it's gotten so bad domestically in some ways that, you know, I try to do a lot of work with, say, the Quincy Institute, which is a lot of conservatives and a lot of people that are liberal and even left of, you know, mainstream Democrats, people that are more Bernie Sanders supporters. And people are always surprised. They're like, conservatives and liberals and Bernie supporters agreeing on things? I mean, that's a real problem when domestically people are treating their politics as some, I don't know, tribal sport, like a gladiatorial battle.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think also the places like the Quincy Institute also illustrate the fact that some of the old categories and old distinctions are breaking down. They don't fit as well. So again, this is overly simplistic, but 40 years ago, you might have said, well, Republicans are sort of pro-business, low taxes, and tough on national security. That's their, you know, think of Ronald Reagan. That's your sort of defining Republican. And Democrats are, you know, more interested in social programs, less inclined to support defense, et cetera, and more willing to, you know, tax people. That would be the crude way of distinguishing red versus blue 30, 40 years ago. If you think about it now, those things don't work anymore. There's a whole lot of Republicans that are not actually very big on national security. They don't want to spend money on defense. There are Democrats that are quite hawkish, right? You think of Hillary Clinton was a very hawkish Democrat as well. So that set of categories that used to be able to define the two parties, I think, has broken down in a variety of ways. And that then produces alliances uniting some progressives and some, I would say, you know, traditional conservatives who would like the United States to concentrate more on problems here at home, less on trying to do impossible things all over the world. And that, I think, brings progressives and conservatives together on a lot of issues, even if they might disagree on some others.
I just had two more questions for you. I promise to let you go because you've been very generous with your time. The first is, in this article, the second question you ask that you give a no to is, with regards to our foreign policy judgments and whether or not other countries and nation states should follow them and trust them, you say, no, why should they? Why do you take that view?
Well, look at the track record. So not only have we not been such a good example of a country to imitate in terms of what we do at home, but, you know, let's look at our foreign policy. First of all, the United States has been trailing the advanced free world in its response to climate change, which is arguably the single biggest problem humanity faces for the next century. And we are not leading there. I think the Biden administration wants to do more. Whether they'll be able to remains to be seen, but we have not been a leader in that regard. I think we overdid the push for globalization in the 90s and aughts. I like free trade. I think the world is better off when countries trade with each other, but we pushed it too far and too fast. And then if you start looking at the other big steps, whether it's NATO enlargement, which I think ultimately backfired, the mess we have made of the Middle East in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Libya, in Yemen, and elsewhere, mishandling the Middle East peace process, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally, what was the other great objective of this recent period of history? We were going to spread democracy and liberal values around the world. We were going to try and make the free world even bigger. That was originally stated by the Clinton administration and reaffirmed by Bush and reaffirmed by Obama. Last year was the 15th consecutive year in which the level of global freedom declined, according to the New York research organization, Freedom House. And even some of our allies, Egypt, Hungary, Poland, are heading in the wrong direction as well. When you add all that up and you say, well, this is what American foreign policy leadership has brought us, we aren't a country, we shouldn't expect others to hear an American president say, this is what I want us to do, and have everybody fall into line. They have ample reason to question our judgment. And I think that's unfortunate because there are some issues where American leadership, I think, is still needed, very necessary. I think Biden has shown that in some areas it can already accomplish certain things. So again, gets back to your very first question. How do I feel about American primacy? I like American primacy. I just want it to be used much more intelligently for the benefit of Americans and the rest of the world.
So the last question I have for you, and maybe this is a curveball, maybe it isn't, but one of the big concerns for me when we talk about the international rules-based order, and I'm not trying to pull a whataboutism here, but I look at some of the things that happen in Turkey. I look at this NSO group scandal with Israel and everything happening in the West Bank. I look at Saudi Arabia, and it just sort of aggravates me. Do you think we're ever going to see shifts in the way our alliances with these countries work? And I mean, you can't very easily change allies that have been formed over a long course of time. But do you think there's going to be changes in geopolitics and who we work with and what we allow some of our allies to get away with?
Yeah, I think there will be. Whether they will happen as quickly as I might like, I think remains to be seen. I mean, part of this is that we have tended to have a rather unconditional approach to many of our allies, especially in the Middle East, but also elsewhere, where we would back them regardless of what their conduct was. We would back Egypt even when the military overthrows a democratically elected government, and we wouldn't even call it a coup. Right, back when John Kerry was Secretary of State, refused to use that word because that had actually legal implications if he did. We don't do anything when the government of Saudi Arabia murders a journalist in their embassy in Turkey as well, because he was unpopular with the ruler of Saudi Arabia. We don't put any real pressure on Israel to stop consolidating what is, for all intents and purposes, becoming an apartheid state, et cetera. And what we need to recognize is in a lot of these cases, we shouldn't be giving these countries unconditional support. We should be supporting the things that they do that we approve of, that we like, and we should be distancing ourselves or making our displeasure known in more than just a statement by the Secretary of State or the press secretary that we deplore a situation. I think that's something that we are in a still sufficiently favorable position to do. And I think we are likely to see a bit more of that in the future.
Do you think the flip side of that is true? I know we're having a lot of growing tensions with China, but is it possible that we could work with China on, say, things like, climate change?
Yeah, this is, I think, probably the biggest challenge that the Biden administration and subsequent administrations will face. China is going to be, the other major power in the world. We are going to have a difficult relationship with China simply for power reasons, but also because our values are substantially different in a variety of ways. And yet, as that competition is going on, we also have to be able to work with the Chinese on climate change more than anything else, but also on a number of other issues where, in this case, our interests do align. We're not directly at odds. And how you balance that, how you compete like blazes in some areas, but cooperate in the areas where it's essential, is a tough diplomatic challenge. And you have to do all of that while hopefully not getting into an unintended war with an increasingly powerful country.
Well, Stephen Walt, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I didn't even get to get your thoughts on Iran. That's been in the news lately, but we'll have to talk about that another time. How can my listeners keep up with your work? And, I know you're a realist. I know you're a pessimist, but what would you say to all these young, bright-eyed kids I know at the university down the street that are like, I want to get involved in international relations and law, and I want to help the world?
I would say two things. One, I have been doing this now for 40 plus years, and it's been fascinating throughout. So on the one, from a selfish level, it's really a wonderful career. And secondly, my generation has set the bar sufficiently low that the next generation can almost certainly improve upon our performance.
And how can my listeners get a hold of your new book?
The new book, well, it's now, I guess, about 2.5-3 years old, The Hell of Good Intentions. You can find it at Amazon. You can find it in a lot of different places online now. And if they want to keep up with what my latest thinking is, they can follow my foreign policy column, which is at www.foreignpolicy.com.
And any chance you think we'll get back into the JCPOA? Promise to let you go. I promise after this.
I think there is still a chance, but I think the window is closing pretty rapidly.
Well, thank you again, Stephen Walt.
Okay, nice talking with you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Stephen Walt. Be sure to check out his regular column at foreignpolicy.com. And if you enjoyed our conversation, please consider picking up his book, The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite, and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. As always, if you enjoy what I do, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon or PayPal. If you want to donate to me on PayPal, just shoot me an email or a Twitter DM, and we can arrange that. But if you can, support me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. I am dealing with some trials and tribulations, taking care of a family member right now, and your support is what will keep this show going. You can donate at the lowest, at the $1 tier. You can also donate at the $5 tier. You'll get bonus content like video versions of Parallax Views interviews, as well as archived editions of the Parallax Views show that are only available now on Patreon. And of course, there is the $10 and $15 tier, both of which get producers credits. At the $15 tier, you can request to speak with me, my time permitting,
for a monthly chat session on Zoom or Skype. So feel free to contribute at those tiers as well if you can afford it. And that leads us to the producer's credit shout-out. Shout-outs to Ed, James, Jamie, Ork, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Gratz, Martin, The War Nerd, Emilia, Brian, and Mickey. Get your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views like those Patreon supporters by joining the $10 or $15 tiers at my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.